The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Okay, so it's spring break.
Yes.
Means that my oldest son, Ben, is home.
Hi.
And it also means that my youngest son, Noah, is not at school. But this week, we are bringing out a podcast. I bring out a podcast every week. You know, half the time, the podcasts are free for everybody. And everyone enjoys them. And half the time, all they get is like maybe 5 minutes. That's like the teaser.
Oh, that's my favorite half.
They just get a few minutes of the podcast, and then they have to sign up to get the
podcast. Well, that's the best part. Why would anyone sign up to hear the part where you talk? The only reason
I have guests on. There are interviews in the podcast, and people like to listen to who I'm interviewing. This week is Adam Proctor, who is the podcast host of the Dead Pundit Society. And he is on the podcast because in a patron-only podcast that I put out with Derek Varn, Varn and I think rather snarkily, said, oh yeah, that Adam Proctor, he's a social democrat. We can't trust Adam Proctor, or something like that.
So just
and,
to spite
and
Varn.
Proctor got caught wind of this and contacted me and said, hey man, I'm not a social democrat. I'm a nice guy. And so he came on my podcast and we talked about it. But that's what's going to be on this podcast this week, is me just debating, not really debating, just discussing social democracy and socialism and Marxism with Adam Proctor.
Wow.
So I should say that anyone who likes this podcast should become a patron, and that when we reach 600 patrons, I'm going to start making Communism 101 videos just for the patrons.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to call it, and let's see, what else would I say? Oh, we should make a song that we'll play during this introduction. What kind of song do you think it should be?
I think it should be Macintosh 420. Shop.
Adam, I'm glad to have you on the podcast. We were talking about you on the podcast last week, I guess, or maybe the week before, the way this is going to fall. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to come on and respond to some of the things that were said, because we were calling you a dirty, rotten social democrat and all sorts of other things. And you deserve the time to respond. So I'm glad to have you on the podcast to do that, and also just to chat about the Dead Pundit Society and the left. And we'll go at it.
Doug, thanks so much for having me back on the show. I'm a big fan of the show and a listener, but I got to say your intro kind of made me sound like, a real petty bitch, like my ears were burning. I've got thin skin and now I'm here to defend myself. But I think this will be a fun chat. I think this will be a lot of fun. I think that you and I will be a meeting of the minds of sorts, and your listeners are in for a real treat.
Yes, that's exactly right. But I'm not trying to say you're thin skinned. I would just say that your skin could use a little thickening. So, No. All right. So let's talk seriously here about this question about being a social democrat, or what that is and what it means. And I'll start by just saying that I don't believe that in today's left, at least in the United States, that there is anything or any political stance you can take that is not basically going to come down to being a social democratic position that has any shot at mainstream electoral success. And not only that, I'd go further and say those political movements that exist that are aiming at a different, more thoroughgoing kind of socialism are in massive disarray and have been for decades. I mean, it's not as though there's a vital living socialist tradition in the United States is being obscured by this new uptick in interest in, let's call it, democratic socialism. That's not the case. The only vital kind of socialism that's on the table anywhere in the U.S. is the DSA version, the Bernie Sanders version, the AOC version. So I'll just give you that to start with. But nonetheless, in theory, there are differences between, say, a Marxist understanding of socialism and Michael Harrington's understanding of socialism, or the DSA's understanding of socialism.
Well, I just want to jump in here. First and foremost, I know next to nothing about Michael Harrington. I'm not a Harringtonite. I respect a few people out there who are inspired by Harrington. Bhaskar Sankara sort of cut his teeth on Harrington. I think when he was like 12, I don't know, when he was Boy Wonder, like reading Marx and Harrington. And he has a certain set of politics that, you know, people agree and or disagree with. But he's been very inspired by Harrington. And he's no wishy-washy Marxist, I would say, in terms of – he has a very serious Marxist analysis.
I'll have him on my show to attack him some other time.
Yeah, but what I want to suggest is that I don't mean to bash Harringtonites. I don't consider myself one. And to be honest, I see him as a relatively peripheral figure in the history of Marxism. I take my cues much more from the kind of rich traditions of you know, the German Social Democrats and even Kautsky. Kautsky, you know, the man who is much maligned on this Marxist left, and then of course the rich traditions going in and through Eurocommunism, the left, you know, the left movements, of course, inside of Eurocommunism, not right Eurocommunism. So I just, in terms of DSA and Harrington and all of that, that doesn't really influence me or weigh much on my mind in terms of these types of things. But I take your setup, to be one to suggest that what actually exists in the world today, in the real political movements of today, is a certain kind of a social democratic orientation. I think we need to sort of – moving forward, we'll need to definitely define our terms pretty rigorously, I think.
Just to start, I have this quote from Engels, which to me defines the difference between thoroughgoing socialist politics and what I'll take to be a redistributist social democratic politics. And Engels says that – he stated that Marx's work contains a simple fact covered up by covered up under ideological overgrowth that man must, before all else, eat, drink, live, and clothe himself, and can only then engage in politics, science, art, religion, etc., and that therefore the production of the immediate material means of existence and thereby the corresponding degree of economic development of a people or a period form the basis on which the state institutions, legal views, art, and even religious ideas of the people concerned developed, and on which they therefore must be explained and not vice versa. What that means to me is that when you're talking about socialist politics, the first thing you're really aiming at changing wouldn't be even state institutions, but the mode of production. It's very flat-footed kind of Marxist position that the primary aim of a proletariat political movement should be to take hold of, seize, and then transform. And that part about transformation is really key. And transform the means of production, transform the basis of society to make it socialist. And then once you agree with that, then there's still a whole realm of debate that's open at that point as to how to do that. But would you take this on as the difference between a social democratic position and a more rigorously Marxist socialist one? That is that the social democratic position is mostly concerned about political power and redistribution and equality maybe before the law and modifying religious ideas or something like that, rather than transforming the mode of production, the way we – the social relationships that are key to how we make the world.
A couple of things. I mean, I think that's necessarily a false dichotomy. I want to explain why, but I also just want to insist first and foremost that I don't consider myself a social democrat. I define, for sure. Now, there are people that I've had on my show, one Michael Walker from Novara Media, who describes himself as a class war social democrat, which I think is an interesting kind of way of framing that question as a response to that question. And I find very little differences, practically speaking, between myself and Michael Walker. So in that respect, maybe a class war social democrat might fit me. But the way that I'd like to explain the trajectories and the development of social democracy throughout the 20th century is by way of kind of this is how Marxism, the Marxian tradition, came up against the complexities of the capitalist state as it developed and as it modernized in the 20th century. And the way that I like to look at Kautsky versus Lenin is not in terms of these programmatic differences necessarily, but the differences in the actual national formations that they found themselves in. You have Kautsky in a relatively modern, industrialized German state, that had many of the trappings of, a kind of bureaucratic, technocratic, state administration, the one that we find ourselves in today in the United States and other countries across the world. Whereas Lenin, of course, in Gramsci's formulation, sort of found himself in a kind of backwards czarist regime. And I think that the differences in their strategies, their strategic orientations, stem much more directly from the differences that they found themselves, in their practical political struggles, more so than any kind of programmatic differences. So in that sense, I don't know. I mean, is Kautsky less of a Marxist than Lenin, or did he find himself in a different kind of political situation with a liberal, democratic parliamentary structure? I don't know. I don't know. I think these are really interesting questions, and now I'm rambling.
My position is not one in which I want to embrace Lenin as opposed to Kautsky. For me, the important question is I'm one of these people who, for a variety of reasons, partly probably due to my lack of education, want to return to Marx himself rather than concern myself with which Marxist that came after is closer to his actual doctrine or understanding. And so that what that means is I have to attempt to become my own Marxist, right, rather than embracing.
Yep. I think that's laudable. I think that's laudable. We should all try to do that. And I think going back to your Engels quote, I mean, really, that's a very a far more eloquent conception of just base superstructure in a sense. And I mean, we can argue there are many arguments to be had as to, how wedded was Marx to that base superstructure formulation? Was that something that was meant to be published and sort of foregrounded as his understanding of the state and society and the capitalist mode of production, par excellence? Or was that kind of a throwaway line? Did he spend the rest of his career modifying and adding complexity to that model in real profound ways? And his writings on the Civil War in France and the Paris Commune, I think he did. But respectable, well-intentioned socialists and Marxists can disagree on that account. But that's essentially what Lenin rather. Jesus, listen to me, Doug. I've got too many Marxists on the brain. That's essentially what Engels was referring to. Would you at least – can we start?
So this is – okay. Here's the interesting thing about that base superstructure distinction. It covers up a lot of complexity. When you are talking about social relations, it's easy to kind of push all of them into the realm of the superstructure, because that's where when we think about superstructure, the culture, the everyday experiences that we have, the kinds of concerns we have as individuals, those all appear to be superstructural. And the kinds of ideas that we have about who we are, and who should have power and who shouldn't, those are all kind of also seem to be superstructural. What's interesting about the Marx's conception and explanation of the base of society, the material production, is that it includes a kind of a superstructural component. It's not strictly or an idealist component. It doesn't strictly come down to how you put widgets into onto a conveyor belt, or it's not only about the physical conditions or even the technological conditions that define production. It's also about how people are organized around production. And what's very important for Marx is how a certain class of people only have their labor power to sell and therefore fit into a market economy differently than the capitalist class. And because of that key social difference, the whole development of capital sort of takes off. Without that distinction between two groups of people, without a group of people who had nothing to sell but their labor, you wouldn't have capitalist production as Marx understands it. To say that it's a false dichotomy makes a lot of sense on that level. But it still is the case that that particular social relationship is very different than even, let's say, the relationship between a priest and a member of his flock, or other kinds of hierarchical relationships, a principal and a student, because that hierarchical social relationship is a productive one. It has material consequences that are regular, that regulate society.
In this installment, I'm going to say some things about the metaphor of base and superstructure in Marx's theory. This concept was developed very early on by Marx and Engels as they reacted to the idealism of the young Hegelians. The metaphor of base and superstructure is used by Marx and Engels in their argument that the economic forces of production and the economic relations of production, that is, the material base, determines the forms of social consciousness in a society and the structure of the ruling order. An early articulation of the concept of base and superstructure is found in Marx and Engels' critique of the idealism of the young Hegelians in The German Ideology, written in the mid-1840s. They write, "Civil society embraces the whole material intercourse of individuals within a definite stage of the development of productive forces. It embraces the whole commercial and industrial life of a given stage, and, insofar, transcends the state and the nation, though, on the other hand again, it must assert itself in its foreign relations as nationality, and inwardly must organize itself as state."
I think, you know, I mean, I think Engels' remarks, you know, by Marx's graveside, I think that's where they were. Is that correct?
Right, yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah, by Marx's graveside. I mean, he also said there, not encompassed by that quote, you know, Marx was above all a revolutionist. And so I think that speaks, you know, to this question as well about, you know, what has come of Marx the revolutionist in the 20th century, and what does revolution look like, and what are the, you know, the terms by which something like that might come about in these complex societies that we find ourselves in. But the question there to me is more of a general one. It's about how do you produce a certain kind of analysis in the last instance. And this is where I like the "in the last instance." I mean, people produce all kinds of rationalizations about why things happen and why they do things. But in the last instance, you're overdetermined by your position in the relations of production under the capitalist mode of production, right? I mean, it's I think that's, you know, that's what he's getting at ultimately here. Now, historical materialism emerges as a way of trying to connect this in the way that you're doing, to sort of moving instead of just having a kind of like using that materialist, that dialectical materialist insight as a way of sort of analyzing certain social relations and where things, you know, where responsibility for people's actions and the conditions of society sort of find themselves in the final instance. It's sort of constructing an apparatus from the ground up of what this is what the capitalist mode of production looks like, and this is where this stems from, and everything is sort of owed to this base. And I think it's an important strategic insight, because, you know, if you want to fall a tree, think that's if you want to knock down a tree, Doug. You know, if you start up top, if you grab the tallest ladder you can find and you start hacking away at the top branches, you know, the tree's not going anywhere. You need to start, you know, you need to find your way down the trunk somewhere. And eventually, you know, if you could grab one of the roots, if you were large and strong enough, you know, pull it out of the ground, that'd be the best way to do it. The most, you know, final way of dispatching that tree. And so, you know, that was Marx's other insights about, you know, what is it to be radical? It's to grab things by the roots. Mm-hmm. And so this emphasis on the material, the sort of material relations of production is emphasizing that very thing, is that if you sort of hack off the branches, they'll grow back the following spring. You need to grab the mode of production by the roots. The question is, how do you do that? And I think, boy, if that isn't the $50,000 question or whatever it was back in the 60s when money wasn't worth what it is now.
Right. We seem to agree about about Marx's radical proposals that he wanted to grab, you know, the tree by its roots or the weed by its roots and pull it up. But there's still this terrain where I think we should have some productive debate because, and I really do mean productive debate because, you know, I reach my limit when it comes to politics at around this point of, you know, we need to focus on the labor theory of value. We need to focus on the mode of production. We need to think about a society that would be organized on a different material basis. You know, I say those things and I have a few vague dreams about what that would look like, but I don't have what I would think of as a political strategy for getting there. But what I have encountered is that once you enter the realm of political strategy, that question of really transforming the mode of production tends to evaporate and has always done so.
It takes a back seat in the analysis at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm right. And that's why Marx's critique of the Gotha program wasn't published and also why it existed. It's because when the SPD took on the mantle of Marx and tried to create a revolutionary party, it was unable to even in the writing of its program to coherently hold on to Marx's categories. And so he came along and critiqued the Gotha program, and then it got only worse, and Engels critiqued the Erfurt program. And we have a long history as socialists of not being able to do a lot with Marx's categories and shifting into a different approach. So what do you think about that, and why do you think that happened? Or am I mischaracterizing the history of socialism there?
No, I think that's right. I think that's right. But the way that I choose to look at this is to not, you know, look at the subsequent Marxists' degeneration or their subsequent Marxists kind of turning away from this true spirit of Marx. But I see, you know, the complexity and the organization of human society in what would later become the capitalist state, the full-on capitalist state that emerges, you know, really doesn't really emerge fully until post-World War II. What I see is that complexity outpacing Marx in a kind of tragic way. In the early days of Marx, you have a very simple state, aristocratic still in nature. You had, you know, the legacy of Chartism was there. Of course, you had some form of representative democracy, but it was certainly not one in which the working classes were able to participate. It wasn't until 1848 and the revolutions there led by socialists and proto-Marxists, you might say, people who would become leaders in the First International, that you had anything resembling, you know, expanded suffrage. Forget about universal suffrage. And so suffrage, the right to vote was very slowly and unevenly being extended to the lower and under classes. And so you didn't see any kind of participation by the working class in the state until much later in the 19th century. And in Europe, I should say that in the United States, because of the legacy of slavery and white supremacy, you saw the incorporation of white males into the electoral system much earlier, which also in many senses accounts for why there wasn't a labor party in the United States, whereas they emerged quite organically in Europe. But anyway, that's another long, twisted story. But that's to say that what Marx is grappling with in the critique of the Goethe program is when you have the German Social Democrats who decide to enter the state as a quasi-working class, political party formation of a sort with its kind of cross-class alliances that comprised it. You have suddenly a requirement that the people engaging in this activity take on the suppositions of bourgeois democracy, which is that you have this notion of a fair wage, right? A fair wage. What a beautiful thing, says the Marxist. Ha, hilarious. There's no such thing as a fair wage. And this is what Marx is responding to. He's saying, you call yourself Marxists, and you believe that, you're essentially you're naturalizing this unequal exchange that's grounded in capitalist exploitation by calling for fair wages. But this is what the political actors found themselves engaging in at the turn of the century when these working class political parties attempted to enter the state, that you have to take on the rhetoric and the kind of institutional logic of the state as a representative force in order to try to use it as a terrain of struggle. And that fundamentally alters the way that we have to think and speak and strategize and conceptualize things like the wage relation, the employer relation. And very soon after that, you see the German Social Democrats getting in big, big trouble, voting for war credits in the lead up to World War I, because their interests as a class were tied up with the interests of the nation. And you have these kind of twisted and convoluted forms of consciousness that emerge when the working class leaves these little working class enclaves in Birmingham, England, and tries to enter a complex liberal bourgeois state.
Right. So, I mean, and this is my this story from the past is something I'm concerned about now, because I see that at least I can begin to see an outline of a correlation between, let's say, commitment to the working class interests within a country and a nationalist ideology that might come along with that. That because when you think of the working class interest in terms of redistribution of the surplus and something like a fair wage or access to universal healthcare even, you are still pitting aspects of the working class, along national lines or ethnic lines against each other. And especially when you take into account the uneven development of different nations and their different capacity to provide different levels of technological, say, intervention in medicine, are definitely setting the working class against itself, even as you are rightfully, I think, working in the interests, immediate interests of working people in your own nation. So it's tricky to have a long-term view to see the complications and at the same time have a politics that can operate in the moment, that can actually seek power. And it's not because the reason it's tricky is not because, let's say, the working classes are just they don't think things through enough. They're not educated enough. It's because those working class people are facing real problems in the moment, and they know fairly accurately what's in their immediate interest.
Yeah, people know what side their bread is buttered on,
right?
Even if it's the side that is contradictory to their class position and their demands of their long-term success.
It's sort of kind of like having a disease, and you are given a medication that will in some ways kill you faster, but also will alleviate your immediate symptoms.
So I think that's the fundamental insight of a materialist approach to the world, is that people are motivated by the conditions that are not of their own choosing, right? Even when they try to struggle against them. Well, this might seem like I'm peeling back a little bit, but this is one of the things I want to get to, two distinctions here. I think the first one that I want to get down and think through with you here, Doug, and this will be a winding chat, is one of the things I try to make is what I really like about the Poulantzis and the Miliband debate. People who are state theory nerds or have listened to DPS or other shows, whatever, will know this kind of – there was a Marxian state debate in the 1960s and 70s between two people, Ralph Miliband and Nicolas Poulantzis. And Ralph Miliband kind of held down a more kind of classical Marxian understanding, what others have I think falsely called an instrumentalist version of the state, wherein, you know, the classical line of the, you know, the state is the executive committee of the bourgeoisie, and they sort of carry out the will and the needs of the capitalist class, of course, with various other hangers-on from other classes. But it's always a kind of what I call a unilinear approach, which means that the relations of production, the class forces in the abstract relations of production in capitalism are unilinearly reflected into the state. So that there's the working class who's sort of outside the state necessarily. There's the ruling classes that sort of get projected into the state in a one-to-one relationship, that the state looks like the abstract relations of production. And then on the other side, you have Nicolas Poulantzis, who went through several iterations of his kind of stylistically. He was Althusserian in the beginning of his career, well, the second phase of his career rather. And towards the end, he dropped a lot of the Althusserian trappings, but I think he remained remarkably consistent because he said, contra to Miliband, he said, but there's a political displacement of the relations of production that happens in the capitalist state. Which is to say the state – there's not a one-to-one kind of relationship from the relations of production to the state. That the state operates as a kind of a refractory mechanism, and necessarily so. The classes are only abstract in Marx's relations of production. They have to become manifest and concrete in and through the capitalist state. And he has a very expansive notion of the state, much like Gramsci's integral state, which is not just like the institutions and the politicians, but it's a generalized kind of field of relations. It's not a thing; it's a relation, and it's the field on which classes actually are cohered. And so here's a critical distinction. I was actually talking about this with a friend of mine this morning. A classical Marxist, a unilinear Marxist, will look at the say the National Labor Relations Act, some of the crown jewel of the New Deal set of reforms. They would look at that and they would see that as the death knell of the working class movement. Why? Because you have this genuine, true working class abstract relation that is somehow bastardized and co-opted by the state. A Poulantzian, on the other hand, would look at that act and look at that as class formation itself, that this process of institutionalization of the working class in these sanctioned entities was a process of class formation, that there wasn't some kind of inchoate abstract class that existed prior to that. And sure, it's riven with contradictions. We saw a lot of those unravel through the kind of business unionism of the 1950s and 60s into the present. But that's actually class formation. Does that make sense in terms of that?
Familiar? I'm not really at all familiar with this particular debate. Correct me if I'm misunderstanding it. But one thing that I notice right away coming out of – because I had spent some time with various Marxist humanists. And one thing that I notice is that there's this assumption there that some aspect of the capitalist society actually is directly reflected in the political apparatus, and more importantly, that there are classes that really are represented by the capitalist structure. So to put it more simply, like there's this idea that the capitalist class has real interests, which they then act out through the state. But what I would say is that one of the key things to understand about capitalism is that it is dehumanizing. That is that you have an abstract system of material relations that directs society rather than the interests of any class, including the capitalist class, that the capitalist class as people, as real sentient beings, are really in service of a structure, a kind of relation, much more than they are in charge of it. and that, you know, the degree to which they're successfully at, you know, like successful at relating to it and keeping it going without a crisis is up in the air. It's contingent. It's not, there's nothing guaranteed about that. So, that would be the first thing I would say, is that I wouldn't hold that the capitalist class as a political class is fully in charge of it, of capitalism.
The state, the way that's oftentimes encapsulated, the state is necessarily an alienated social relation.
Right.
In that way. Is that
right.
More or less what you're
putting forward? Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that would be the first thing I'd say. And then the second thing I'd say is that it's important to remember that from a Marxist point of view, the working class interest is not to take a political power as a class. Not in the long term. Their primary interest is to abolish themselves as a class, to eliminate this relation, to get beyond this relation. So if you hold with that, then the reason once they are politicized as a class and have institutional powers as a class within capitalism, that's the death knell of their movement towards self-emancipation and transformation. It's not necessarily the death knell of a political movement for them as a class fixed within this alienated society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that would be my – I don't know which side of the debate I fit in with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny. The way that you laid out the beginning there, I thought to myself, well, that's a Polanskian understanding of the state as a kind of relation, which always overdetermines any one individual or even any one fraction, a class fraction, so to speak, and that it's always in a sense in crisis because of that. But then again, towards the end of that, you sort of articulate a very Milibandian kind of understanding in a certain way. And to be fair, you know, both sides, both Miliband and Polanski, have a much higher level of sophistication than I can present right now. I'm a little rusty on all of this stuff, to be honest. But what you've presented is as you sort of mentioned at the outset, is a very well articulated and even for a long time, I would say dominant way of looking at the Marxist conception of the state. And so far as the state is an alienated social relation and that it doesn't really reflect the kind of true species being, certainly not of the working class, but not even the sort of real aims and goals and fullest expression of the members of the ruling class. Marx actually speaks quite beautifully and sometimes even sympathetically about the ruling class and the way their relationship in this system degrades them as well in many senses. Of course, we're not going to cry crocodile tears.
No.
But the alienated social relation exists for them just as much as it does.
Right. They just drive much better cars and have better health insurance and live longer lives and, you know, and so on and so on. But
they can cry to Lana Del Rey while they eat caviar.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't
right,
matter.
Right.
Me.
Right.
But to say is, you know, what I would push back is to question. The reason why I fall on the Polanskian side of things here is that I think class formation is everything, because just as it is the case in the early Marx anyway, that these sort of abstract relations of production, these classes sort of exist, he's just as eager, just as, you know, just as insistent, and particularly in later on in his career when he's writing, you know, Capital, just as insistent that the relations of production also serve to separate and break up in members of the working class, set them against one another, places them in competition on the labor market. Undermines their solidaristic impulses that they may have as members of the same class. And so it's just, to me, workers are just as likely to set each other, you know, to slit each other's throats as they are to join hands if you're just looking at the relations of production, which is why to me, class formation in and through the state and its institutions and this kind of what I'm calling a political displacement of the relations of production is everything. Because it's that terrain, it's that process by which it's possible for workers to come together in certain types of ways to fight for to enhance their capacities in the state and in society in general. Which brings me to a really key distinction. And I'm sorry if this is premature. We can circle back to what we were just talking about if you'd like. But I think that there's a really economistic way of looking at social democracy that versus socialism, rather, that I think that we're falling prey to a little bit here, because I think that's the dominant one, right? So that social democracy is different from socialism because insofar as it would like to preserve markets, it would like to fundamentally preserve the capitalist mode of production, whereas socialism is trying to uproot it by the roots and undermine it and produce something different.
So, okay, let's talk about this economism that I'm mired in, Adam, because
– Well, I think it's not just you. It's most everyone, and I think that there's a different way to look at this, and it's one that I've only really kind of started to explore. So, yeah, let's talk about this. Maybe I can help clarify my own thoughts.
Okay. Well, here's what I think. I think that if you embrace if you embrace Marx's key categories and think they're really important, or put it less charitably, if you're economistic like I am, then you don't feel that everyone thinks this way. And what you feel is that everyone is always calling you names. You're always being called the economistic. But if you are on the other side of that equation, then you're surrounded by people like me. In other words, your critics are going to be the opposite of what you are. So there, you know, that's what you see. So my feeling here is that a lot goes on in society that isn't directly related to these economic categories. And that you can have, let's say just in a family, you know, you can have relationships that, that aren't determined by who makes the most money. You could both be of the same class, but you know, you're going to be dealing with something like sexism instead of, exploitation. I think that you could still trace that back and kind of see economic foundations for gender roles in society, but in the immediate moment, it's not simple to do that and not necessarily even particularly helpful, in the immediate moment. So, you know, like if my wife says to me, why don't you do the dishes more often? And I say, well, you know, originally the gender roles were divided the way they were for these materialist reasons. That's not going to really,
You're saying that's not how you win an argument.
That's not going to help me. So. Right. So I grant that, right? But I still think that when you're thinking about radical transformation, that you do need to go to this other level, and think really hard. And it's a very difficult process to get from that level to political action that, you know, that you can actually proceed with in the moment. So that's all
I don't disagree with that. I just want to be clear. I don't disagree with that because I think there's a way in which people use economism in that way that you're defending yourself against, I think rightfully so. That's fundamentally anti-Marxian. It's an anti-Marxist slur to call someone economistic in an academic context. That's red baiting. So I want to be clear. I'm not doing that. What I'm suggesting is I think there's a dialectic at work here, and I think this has to be a both and an and yet, right? And so I think there's a political element that differentiates social democracy from socialism. That's just as important, if not perhaps even more important nowadays than the economistic one, the economic and the political sort of dialectic that's held together. And this is, you know, I was talking to a guest of DPS a couple of weeks ago. Luminary in the socialist left, a woman named Hillary Wainwright. She's one of the founding editors of Red Pepper magazine, and she's a super smart fellow traveler of one of my mentors, Leo Panitch, guy who's been on the show quite a bit. And you know, off air, I was referring to Jeremy Corbyn and some of the kind of trappings that he's presented with, the kind of impasse he finds himself in, which is kind of overdetermined and defined by the kind of social democratic orientation. And she really kind of rapped me on the wrist really quickly. You know, she picked up a ruler and smacked me down, rightfully so, I think, in hindsight, because she said, no. What do you mean? Jeremy Corbyn is not a social democrat. Tony Blair is a social democrat. Jeremy Corbyn is a revolutionary who's trying to work in and against the state. Insofar as he's very serious about developing the capacities of the working class, of the average person, to intervene in their lives and control their own destinies. And so politically, you know, being an anti-social democratic socialist means something that I think is really, really important that gets underserved in these more economically oriented debates. And so far as, you know, there is a real legacy of this top-down bureaucratic hierarchical party structure that emerges in the 20th century that is very social democratic in nature. And the way to kind of undermine that, not only economically, but first, I think you need to undermine that politically. And I think, you know, and this is where I give Bernie Sanders a lot of credit, and I think he really means it when he talks about this political revolution that he's trying to help provoke, that he promises to help bring about, you know, should he be elected, and he's already helped to bring it about quite a bit, which is to say that people need to be granted the opportunity to intervene in their own lives and their own destinies. Expands, you know, this means expanding democracy, expanding input in society. It's the true, it's what puts the democratic in democratic socialism. And I think that part is just as important as the socialist part, which is the perhaps more economic part. So I think democratic socialism embodies both this political aspect of going beyond the social democratic trap, as well as the economic aspect. And I think, and what do you make of that?
Well, I think I understand the defense of Corbyn. Like, I can get my mind around why someone would defend him against the charge of being a social democrat by saying, well, he is working to overcome barriers in the state to give working people more power so they can take hold of the reins of power and transform society. That he's what look like maybe redistributist policies or sort of milquetoast reforms are strategic and have a radical aim, and that I would grant him that. I would even grant Sanders that, but not as thoroughly or full throatedly as I would Corbyn.
Sanders needs better policies. He's taking too many cues, unfortunately, from just kind of wishy-washy progressives. And unfortunately, that's because those are the people who are sitting in the policy spheres of American society. And I think we as leftists need to do better. We need to take some.
I just want to point out with Corbyn, though, even as I grant him, that doesn't necessarily mean that I think he's right. It just means that I understand that he has a self-conception which is not merely social democratic. He doesn't have his horizon in his, you know, his aim is not limited to holding on to society as it is and making it fair or something like that, right? But I do have trouble with this idea that Tony Blair was a social democrat. I think that's a slur on social democrats. He was a neoliberal. But maybe that's explain how she justified calling Tony Blair a social democrat.
Well, I think, again, you know, there was a time when Engels was a member of various social democratic parties and formations. And so it becomes something very different throughout the course of the 20th century. And I think, yeah, to be a social democrat today is to be thoroughly tainted by this neoliberal turn. You look at the socialist parties in, the Socialist International very infamously were the ones who implemented austerity across Europe. The Prime Minister of Greece, who was in the PASOK party, my Greek accent is failing me these days. It's been too long, but I'm blanking on this fellow's name. It'll come to me at some point. But he was the president of the Socialist International, and here he was implementing incredibly harsh forms of austerity on Greek society, which spurred on the development, the popularity of Syriza. And of course, you know, Syriza had the opportunity and they shit the bed for a variety of reasons as well. But point being is, yeah, and I think nowadays to be a social democrat is to be thoroughly tainted by this kind of neoliberal logic of austerity and top-down administration and rationalizing, you know, wasteful spending and all of these other types of things.
Okay, with Syriza, which I know a little bit about, not, you know, a ton about, but what I would say about that is that they were social democratic in ideology, that they had the plan of alleviating the misery of working people and everyday people in Greece, of holding out against the European Union, and trying to hold the line against austerity. And they had a vision of they didn't have a revolutionary vision, but they had a left social democratic vision of a better Greece, say. And I would say that Tony Blair, on the other hand, believed that actually getting out of the way of market forces and rolling back some of the social security type of policies that were in place. I don't mean like social security only like we have in the United States, but social safety net kind of policies that undermining those would actually be to the benefit of everyone in the UK. I mean, I believe that he truly was a neoliberal in his ideological vision. Yeah. And now he was in a party that had a long labor tradition that included a social democratic component. But that didn't mean that he himself was holding true to even the social democratic vision. So, you know, and so like, so one of the key things to understand is like, what was it that made Syriza shit the bed? Was it a failure of their policy? Was it a failure of their political vision? Or it might have been that, but it seemed to me also a lot of real economic forces that were just completely stacked against them.
Oh, absolutely. No question. No question. I mean, which is why I rail against the so-called capitulation thesis. That's not to suggest that they did not capitulate, because they did. But the question is, but my suggestion there is that, you know, you can't answer the question by just sort of blaming, people who are insufficiently principled in their Marxism or what have you.
Right.
There are these other overdetermining forces. You know, we, as the old man said, right, over and over again, you know, we do act, we make choices, and those things matter, but we don't do so under conditions of our own choosing. And so it's the conditions of our own choosing part that many socialists across the world sort of conveniently neglect when they analyze various situations.
The only political bludgeon they had against the EU was the threat of leaving, right? And that was no threat at all.
Well, you know, it's like if somebody's holding a gun to your head and you just instead you grab a knife and you stick it up against your stomach and you say, don't shoot me, I'll stab myself.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, you know, that's not – I mean, you know, leaving the EU without a currency, without the institutional kind of apparatuses in place to manage a domestic economy, you know, on your own is – That's not much of a threat. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking a lot about the Greece situation now. I'm planning some episodes in the future to think through this. But I mean, it's an interesting test case. But it really, you know, to me, it's
with Greece, it becomes very clear that the fate of Greece could not be decoupled from the fate of the EU easily, right? That they were really stuck. And they didn't have enough power as a nation to go their own way.
But it goes – I mean, Brexit's a similar dynamic. If there is a Brexit, if they do exit the single market or even, you know, the union entirely, they're still going to stand in relation to the EU. You can't leave – you know, we can't hop on a rocket ship and start over again on Mars. We will always stand in relation to the forces, the broader forces in the global economy, which to me, like, I mean, it's, I guess it's time for me to raise this question to you. I apologize. Sometimes – hell, Doug, I'm forgetting that we're even recording.
That's fine.
I feel like we're just two buds just chatting it up about Marxist theory.
That's what we are. That's what we are. So go ahead.
Yeah. So I'll ask my question to you. I mean, I'm used to being the interviewer here and not the interviewee, but – you know, with that being said, you know, in what situation, what does a principled Marxist approach to politics, what does that look like? Because, you know, for the last millennium, it's really been kind of, you know, overdetermined by this experience of dual power, you know, coming out of revolutionary Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as a strategy has been so thoroughly undermined by a number of things. So I don't know.
I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, to truly clear. Like what I would say is what we should recognize, like my message would be what we should recognize is that we do not have a fully developed politics. That when we, that the worst thing to do is to, behave as though the some of the problems that you can already see don't exist. But I, you know, so to act in a certain way that you know won't work just because it seems like it's ready to hand. But I don't actually have a fully developed political strategy. What I have are problems and I love to share them. But that's not adequate. I mean, especially after Trump, that's not adequate. When Obama was in power, being a guy like me who would say, hey, we need to rethink what the left is doing. We need to reevaluate and then develop a real politics, a revolutionary politics. That seemed fine because it was, you know, it was relatively unthreatening to the actual powers that be. And there wasn't the perception of a huge risk of being essentially apolitical, because in that moment where you say, I don't have a politics, you're being apolitical. You're not acting in that moment. So yeah. So now to say that, you know, it's like you're going to be called a Trumpist by some people, or if you're not full, you know, if you aren't getting that accusation, you're going to be thought of as being kind of a squishy liberal, maybe, because you're not aligning yourself with whatever the forces are and that are ready to hand. So that being said, I've tended to, in a sort of knee-jerk way, just say, yeah, I don't know what our politics are supposed to be. I have to nonetheless get behind what seems like the best chance, which is something like Bernie Sanders' campaign or some sort of social democratic redistributist kind of position, if for no other reason than to hold off the populist right. But I still think we should be very critical of the politics that are ready to hand and take a look at what went wrong in the last 100 years as best we can. When I call someone a social democrat, I'm not actually trying to slur them. I'm actually just trying to understand.
So, I mean, this is where I think the lesson of Kautsky is really important. I'm going to recommend a book to your listeners, and it's one that I just finished, and I absolutely adored it, and I have a number. I'm developing a reading list in preparation for an episode, and it's one, Jesus, Doug, maybe you know, you'll have some actually really mean things to say about me after this one, but it's going to be called something very, you know, provocative, something to the effect of like Kautsky was actually good, though, or something, you know, so like, you know, basically it's going to, I'm going to be standing for Kautsky. And I think that in our day and age, in the political situation that we find ourselves in, Kautsky has the most value to the project that we're trying to pull off. Not because, you know, he was the most Marxist or he was right over Lenin, or he was, you know, deep down in his heart of hearts, his heart was shaped like Marx's beard or whatever. Who the fuck knows? I don't know what was in his heart. I don't know what his intentions were, and I don't care. But what I do know is that he faced a complex capitalist state, at least as complex as a capitalist state could be in those days, head on, and dealt with many of the same kinds of contradictions in a very serious and sober way that we currently find ourselves dealing with. I just don't get down any longer with this kind of dual power insurrectionist, you know, to the barricades, comrades, muzzle loader toting, you know, communistic kind of ideal any longer. I think most of the people who push that have never fired a gun, and they've certainly never been shot at. And so it's one of those be careful what you wish for scenarios. And in that respect, you know, I think we'd all do well to read a little less Trotsky and a little more Kautsky, because Kautsky, it was a much more the same kind of guy and living in much more of the same kind of society that we currently find ourselves in, facing the kinds of problems that you and I are chatting about right
now. Because I don't have a clear conception of what to do politically, I certainly don't have any compulsion or feeling like, oh, if we're not picking up guns, we're not commies or something like that. That's ridiculous. So, because, you know, I don't look at the 20th century as a great success story. I'm with you there, and I'm more than willing to like reevaluate Kautsky or any of the previous revolutionary members of the SPD or any of the, you know, people in the Marxist tradition. But I always want to, when I do that, hold on to the few things that I think I understand, which would be, you know, coming out of capital and what is, you know, what is capitalism. Sure. And
I realize the listeners will have realized this for sure by now because they're not just two buds chatting on the phone. I failed to mention the title of this fucking book, Doug. It's called Karl Kautsky and the Socialist Revolution, 1880-1938. It's by Massimo Salvadori. Mm-hmm. It's translated. He's an Italian fellow, and it's published by Verso. People should pick up this book, and you'll find a revolutionary Kautsky that maybe you didn't know existed. It's not a hagiography. They talk about his limitations and the mistakes that he made, and it really contextualizes his life in the moment that he was in. And I think we'd all do well to kind of return to that. And you're not wrong. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Everybody read your Capital Volume 1, especially.
Right.
Mine is mine is threadbare and it's tattered, and eventually I'm going to need a new.
Right. Co-host or frequent, you know, interlocutor, Derek Varn is on me to read 2 and 3, which I haven't done. So, you know, yeah. Right.
David Harvey's course is pretty good through that. I will submit that I have not read every page of 2 and 3, unlike my volume 1, which is like it's going to be passed down like a family Bible, as far as I'm concerned. But
so, look, would you like to come back and talk about Kautsky after you do that, put that interview out, or you know, come back again and just
yeah.